Good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to welcome you all here to our Gulf Roundtable. As I think all of you know, my name is John Alterman. I run the Middle East program here. We've been running the Gulf Roundtable here for about a year. We look forward to continuing it onward. For those of you who I think may be interested, we have a book coming out called The Vital Triangle, China, the United States, and the Middle East. We'll be having a rollout event on June 24th with Nick Burns and Chaz Freeman. That'll be at lunchtime on June 24th. But right now, it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you Stéphane Lacroix. Stéphane is the owner of a growing fan club because he is emerging as really one of the premier scholars on Saudi Arabia in the Western world. He's now a postdoctoral fellow and a lecturer at Sciences Po in Paris, where he also supervises the Kuwait program in Gulf Studies. He is fluent in not only French, his native language, but also English, Arabic, and Spanish. He has written what I think are some of the most interesting new articles coming out on Saudi Arabia. His dissertation is being turned into a book, which will be coming out in English next year, in French this year, and his dissertation was titled Fields of Discord, Political Sociology of Islamism in Saudi Arabia, 1954 to 2005. There are a lot of people in Washington who talk about Saudi Arabia and don't really know what they're talking about. I think we have the great pleasure of hearing from somebody who's not often in Washington who will talk to Saudi Arabia and really does know what he's talking about. He will talk about fundamentalism at a crossroads, and I am delighted to present to you Dr. Stéphane Lacroix.
Thank you very much, John, for seeing me at CSIS. So my talk today will be about Saudi Islamists. It will be focused on Saudi Arabia and about the changes that have affected Saudi Islamists during the last few years. And as I'm going to argue, one of the main factors that has had an effect on Saudi Islamists in the last few years is the rise in the region of Shia Islamists as a key actor, particularly in Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon. So, first of all, who am I talking about when I talk about Saudi Islamists? Here, I use Islamists to designate all non-state actors who practice some form of activism in the name of Islam. So it's a wide definition of Islamists. Of course, it's not only the violent ones. And in that case, I'm going to focus on the non-violent Islamists. And traditionally in Saudi Arabia, mainstream Islamism is represented by a trend known as Sahwa al-Islamiyya in Arabic, the Islamic awakening. It's generally referred to as the Sahwa. There are other currents in Saudi Islamism, one that we have dubbed rejectionism, another one called jihadism, of course, that you know. Yet, these currents are a minority in Saudi Arabia compared to the Sahwa. The Sahwa really is the mainstream, and it attracts the largest following. So it's really the most influential one, and it's really the one to look at because it's the one that, for the future, will have probably the most the biggest significance or the biggest importance. The Sahwa appeared in Saudi Arabia in the late 1960s, and it appeared as the result of the coming of the thousands of militants from the Muslim Brotherhood who were repressed and persecuted in their countries of origin and who found shelter in Saudi Arabia. They came from Egypt, they came from Syria, some of them came from Iraq, others came from other countries, Yemen as well. They came, of course, at a time of what is generally referred to as the Arab Cold War between Nasser and Faisal, between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. These Muslim Brotherhood activists were the enemies of the secular regimes of the Middle East, and therefore, the enemies of my enemies are my friends, so the Saudis gave them shelter. And there was some kind of coalition led by the Saudi regime that included all these Islamists and these Muslim Brotherhood people. Rapidly, they came to occupy a very central position in the Saudi state because, first, the war between Nasser and Faisal was just not only a war of influence, it was also a war of ideas, a war of propaganda. And, of course, no one in Saudi Arabia was very good at counter-propaganda. The Wahhabis were too traditional, and the educated elites were very few, and they were not really capable of opposing another, like a counter-ideology to Nasser's ideology. So the Muslim Brotherhood would become the main element in the Saudi counter-propaganda apparatus. And they would hold a lot of important positions in the media, in the education sector. We'll come back to that. Also, the Muslim Brotherhood came to Saudi Arabia in the 1960s at the times when the country was modernizing and when it needed educated elites capable of taking part in this modernization. And as you know, King Faisal was looking for some Islamic modernity to oppose Western modernity. And he found that the Muslim Brotherhood, were a good candidates for this modernization, because many of them had masters or PhDs from universities, so they were educated people, and they basically were proposing that Islamic modernity that Faisal was looking for. So in a short time, the Muslim Brotherhood came to occupy very central positions in many, many of the sectors of the Saudi state. And one of these sectors, of course, is the education sector, which was literally built by the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, the curricula were in great part designed by members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that Muslim Brotherhood presence at the core of the Saudi system led to a hybrid between the traditional Saudi religious culture, Wahhabism, and the Muslim Brotherhood's ideology. It is important here to underline that Wahhabism and Muslim Brotherhood ideology represent two very distinct political religious traditions. Wahhabism emerged in the 18th century and after the teachings of Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab. Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab's main concern was with the purity of faith, the purity of creed above all. And he preached Tawhid, the unity of God. And what he meant by Tawhid was that you have to fight non-Orthodox Muslims. And Abdul Wahhab's main targets were the Shia, the Sufis, all forms of popular Islam that he considered as non-Orthodox Islam. And even in Abdul Wahhab's worldview, the only power he could think of were the Ottomans, who were Muslims. So... But for him, of course, non-Orthodox Muslim, and he would condemn the Ottomans. So what I mean is that the Wahhabi worldview is very focused on fighting the non-Orthodox Muslim, fighting the other Muslim that doesn't agree with you, and especially fighting the Sufi and especially fighting the Shia. And later on, some disciples of Abdul Wahhab would bring in a principle that you might have heard of, the loyalty and rejection or rupture, al-wala wal-bara, which means that, you know, you have to stick with the Wahhabis, stick with the people that agree with you, and reject totally the non-Wahhabis. And in the sense of Abdul Wahhab and his descendants, again, they mainly meant these non-Orthodox Muslims in their view. The Muslim Brotherhood's message is much more political, as you know. The Muslim Brotherhood appeared in Egypt in the 1920s, and this was a very different times of colonization, or the end of colonization in the Middle East. And the message of the Muslim Brotherhood would focus on very different things. On the one hand, fighting what they considered corrupt Muslim regimes, and on the other hand, fighting Western influences. But when it comes to other Muslims, to orthodoxy among Muslims, the Muslim Brotherhood have always tended to downplay the sectarian divide, and you will find very little things in the Muslim Brotherhood's writings about the Shia, about the Sufis, and they don't really care. And they even think that, you can ally with these other groups if you share common objectives. So, as a consequence, we see here that Wahhabism and Muslim Brotherhood ideology appears complementary, because they don't talk about the same things, basically. And for that reason, because of that complementarity, the two ideologies would be easy to blend. And that what the Sahwa would do is just to borrow from Wahhabism its anti-non-Orthodox Muslim stance and anti-Shia, anti-Sufi stance, and to borrow from the Muslim Brotherhood, and especially from the teaching of Sayyid Qutb, the hostility to corrupt, so-called corrupt Muslim states and to the West. Yet the first ideologues of the Sahwa would somehow feel that their ideology was a patchwork, and they would try to prove that it was coherent. One of these first ideologues of the Sahwa is Muhammad Qutb, Sayyid Qutb's brother. Muhammad Qutb was jailed in the 1960s in Egypt, and he was freed in 1971. He left to Saudi Arabia, and he became a professor at the University of Umm al-Qura in Mecca. And he became probably one of the founding ideologues of the Saudi Sahwa. And he wrote many, many books that can be considered as the program of the Saudi Sahwa. His most famous book, of course, is called The Jahiliyyah of the 21st Century. Jahiliyyah meaning pre-Islamic ignorance. And, of course, that's a concept that you find in Sayyid Qutb's ideology. So it resonates, of course, with Sayyid Qutb's ideas. But what Muhammad Qutb tries to do is to prove that they are coherent with Wahhabism. And we'll come back to that. So first, what Muhammad Qutb tries to do is to prove that, yes, the starting points and the basic ideas of Wahhabism and Qutbism are just the same. Qutbis and Wahhabis start from the same idea that the world has reverted to Jahiliyyah, to the state of pre-Islamic ignorance. So it's just the same idea. The responses on Abdel Wahhab's side is Tawhid, the unity of God. And on Sayyid Qutb's side, it's Hakimiyya, the sovereignty of God. But then he will say, you know, these basically mean the same things. And he will even try to demonstrate that Sayyid Qutb's ideas are present in Abdel Wahhab's mind. They are implicit. They're just there. Abdel Wahhab just didn't make them explicit, but they were there. For instance, he would say Abdel Wahhab divides Tawhid in three kinds of Tawhid, the unicity of God. He divides it in three categories. The unicity of Tawhid al-Rububiyya, like proclaiming that God is one. Tawhid al-Asma wa Sifat, proclaiming that God and his attributes and names are one. Okay, so that's Tawhid of belief, we could say. And then there's Tawhid of practice, that Tawhid al-Uluhiyya, that when you practice Islam, you practice it in a monotheistic way. You worship only one God. And what Muhammad Qutb would say is that basically in this Tawhid al-Uluhiyya, in this unicity of practice, or this way of practicing only one God, or worshipping only one God, there is a political dimension. And he says, you know, he will try to say that in Abdel Wahhab's writing, it's not very explicit, but it was there. And he calls it Tawhid al-Hakimiyya, which is quite interesting. So he blends the main concept of Wahhabism with the main concept of Sayyid Qutb's ideas or thought. And he says Tawhid al-Hakimiyya is just one part of Tawhid al-Uluhiyya. So it was implicit in Muhammad ibn Abdel Wahhab's writings. Tawhid al-Hakimiyya, of course, means the unicity regarding the sovereignty of God. Means that, yes, it's just like Hakimiyya. God has to rule. So, or states should be ruled according to God's law, so Sharia should be supreme, and you should have pure Islamic states, and the Sharia should control every domain of life. So he basically comes to the same conclusion. He creates that concept of Tawhid al-Hakimiyya as a way to prove that Wahhabism and Qutbism are perfectly coherent. In the 1980s, because of its central position in the Saudi education system, the Sahwa becomes very prominent, and it becomes the dominant force in the Saudi religious sphere. That said, at the time, the Sahwa maintains a close relationship with the Saudi state. It applies Qutbi's teachings to everyone except the Saudi state. Basically says that, yes, Qutbism applies to all other states, but there's only one true Islamic state, and it is Saudi Arabia. That situation changes in 1990 when King Fahad calls on Western troops to protect the kingdom for fear of a potential Iraqi invasion. And the Sahwa, from one day to another, discovers that, well, in the end, Saudi Arabia is not the true Islamic state that they thought it was. And while the activism of the Sahwa in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, can be described as social activism. They focus on society, on spreading their ideas, but they don't have a political program. They're not in opposition. In 1990, from one day to another, the Sahwa becomes in opposition. It applies Qutbism to the Saudi state and not anymore just to Egypt and Syria and whatever. At that time, Sahwa becomes the spearheads an Islamic opposition to the regime in Saudi Arabia, and a few figures emerge that probably you heard of: Salman al-Auda, Safar al-Hawali, Nasser al-Omar, and for 4 years there's a like kind of an episode of Islamic unrest which opposes Sahwa preachers to the state, and it ends in 1994 when the state crushes the Sahwa and arrests most of the leaders, and they're jailed. And until for 5 years, the Sahwa maintains a low profile from 1994 to 1999. In 1999, the Sahwa leaders are freed from jail by Crown Prince Abdullah. They're freed on one condition, that they return to social activism, which was their activity before 1990, and that they move away, they keep away from domestic politics, that they don't talk about state policies. And, well, basically that's what the Sahwa leaders would do from 1999. They would be very keen not to intervene on domestic issues. Yet, and this is what we shall see, they would maintain a continuing interest in regional issues. Of course, regional issues are in principle considered safer than domestic issues. And quickly, from 1999 onwards, the Sahwa leaders would regain their influence, and they would now even have a stronger position, because the regime had always relied for its legitimacy on the official religious establishment, represented by the Mufti. So it was Sheikh Ibn Baz until 1999. Then it became Abdelaziz al-Sheikh, the current Mufti. But, well, after the days of Ibn Baz, the Saudi religious establishment is considerably weakened. Ibn Baz was a very charismatic figure. Well, even when in 1990... the Saudi religious establishment legitimized the call for Western troops to protect the kingdom, Ibn Baz was so charismatic that he could take the shock, that his legitimacy could stand the challenge. But, well, Ibn Baz was the only person capable of doing that. And the whole episode of Islamic unrest in the 1990s had been very detrimental to the credibility of the Saudi religious establishment. So with that loss of credibility and with the death of Ibn Baz, the Saudi religious establishment had lost much of its legitimizing power. So from 1999 onwards, the regime would increasingly rely on the new or on the freed Sahwa sheikhs for its legitimacy. And they would even constitute, after some time, what some people have called an alternative religious establishment. As a consequence, the regime would open new spaces for the Sahwa preachers. It would allow them to create internet web pages and websites. It would allow them to have shows on Saudi TV or on Al Arabiya, on NBC, for instance. Yet, this is double-edged. Because while the Sahwa uses these spaces to reinforce the legitimacy of the regime, at least by refraining from domestic criticism, it also uses them to voice concerns about regional and more generally external issues. And these concerns sometimes go against the official line of the state. On the big issues, such as 9/11, the Sahwa has made sure not to take any controversial stance. And as you know, Sahwa preachers have all condemned the bombings of 9/11 in more or less ambiguous terms. Salman al-Auda was quite explicit in his denunciation of the bombings. Safar al-Wali, of course, was a bit more ambiguous, and Sahwa has always been more ambiguous than Salman al-Auda on many of these issues. Yet, on issues such as Iraq, the Sahwa preachers have taken much more controversial stances. An example of these controversial stances is what is generally referred to as the Fatwa of the 26, which was proclaimed in November 2004, when 26 figures of the Sahwa described jihad in Iraq as legitimate and called on Saudis to help the Iraqi Mujahideen in any possible way. Of course, that's a very ambiguous statement, because depends what you understand by every possible way. So, of course, it was a way to enhance their own credibility on the Saudi Islamic sphere by even taking a position that could please the radicals. You know, that you could understand as saying, if you want to go fight in Iraq, you can go, because any possible way can implicate that Saudi Islamists could cross the border and go fight in Iraq. So, of course, that was a very embarrassing statement for the regime, because many of these individuals were professors in the kingdom's universities. So to the eyes of foreign observers, they appeared as semi-officials. So it was very embarrassing. The fatwa of the 26th in November 2004 is also very important because it marks the end of the unity of the Sahwa. From then on, the Sahwa would split into two groups. And the main reason for this split would be the attitude to adopt regarding the rise of Shia Islamists as a political force in Iraq, Iran, and Lebanon. Some Sahwi preachers, some preachers from the Sahwa, especially Nasser al-Omar and Safar al-Hawali. Safar al-Hawali has been sick since 2006, so he's less vocal now, but he was, of course, one of the proponents of that line. Some of these Sahwa preachers would see the rise of Shia Islamism as a threat, but they would see it mainly for religious reasons. Shia are infidels, they would argue, and of course they would argue in a very Wahhabi fashion, and therefore Shia should not be supported and they should be fought. So when, for example, Hezbollah attacks Israel in summer 2006, they condemn the attack. And Nasser al-Omar, when asked about, you know, why are the Shias attacking Israel, or why is Hezbollah attacking Israel, he says, oh no, that's a plot, that's a conspiracy by the Shia, mastermind by Iran, and they're doing this because they want to make Shia, Sunnis saying that they're their friends. So they're trying to deceive the Sunnis by attacking Israel to make them think that they're their friends. But the ultimate aim is to fool them. So don't believe what the Shia do.
But he's onto them.
Sorry?
He understands. He sees right through that.
Yeah, for him it's a big conspiracy, and they're trying to fool the Sunnah, right. Trying to arouse sympathy among the Sunnah. But you shouldn't be deceived, of course. Of course, the same group, Nasser Omar and Safar Hawali, when it comes to Iraq, they've been very instrumental in encouraging sectarian strife. They've called on the Sunnah to fight against the Shia. And they've said that the main enemy in Iraq even is not the Americans, it's the Shia. Because the main war that's going on now in the Middle East is Sunnah versus Shia. So even for them, and to some extent the Americans or the Western troops in Iraq, come second. Even Nasser al-Omar recently has explained that there's a big Shia master plan. So it involves Hezbollah, it involves the Iraqi Shia, it involves Iran, it involves al-Houthi in Yemen. Because for him, of course, he considers al-Houthi as a Shia, which is very debatable, of course. It involves the Bahraini Shia. It involves even the Saudi Shia. And, of course, this master plan is to surround the Arabian Peninsula, the cradle of pure Islam, and to destroy it. And and he even explained that the Saudi Shia now are trying to, that was a week ago, are trying to buy land from the Sunnah because they're trying to colonize Sunnah areas in the Arabian Peninsula. And they're trying to, and that's what he says, they're doing exactly what Israel is doing with the Palestinians. Of course, he's trying to make reference to a very emotional issue. And yes, he's defending this idea of a big master plan to destroy Wahhabism and a master plan led by Iran and all the region's Shia. And even was in Saudi Arabia, and I was talking with one of the followers of Nasser al-Omar, and it was quite interesting. He was saying that the priority now is to fight the Shia even more than fighting the Americans or the Israelis. And he would say the Prophet started by fighting the politists, and then he fought the people of the book. So, of course, since for these people the Shia are the politists, they are the priority. So it's an interesting evolution. On the other side, you have other preachers from the Sahwa in Saudi Arabia, and this group is led by Salman al-Auda and Awad al-Gharni. And these argue that, yes, the Sunnah have differences with the Shia, but the two groups share common objectives, and they have common enemies. And they can therefore work together to achieve these common objectives. And, of course, that sounds very Muslim Brotherhood-like. For this group, Iraqi unity should be preserved. And they've always, Salman al-Auda in his statements, for instance, always defending the idea of Iraqi unity. And when he attacks the Shia in Iraq, and he does so sometimes, he always attacks them in political terms. He says, yes, because they're cooperating with the Americans, whatever. But he does not attack them for being Shia or in religious terms, which, of course, is a big difference with the other group. Also, these same group, Salman al-Awda and Awad al-Gharni and some others, they've created considerable controversy in summer 2006 by supporting Hezbollah in its attack on Israel. And of course, that was a position that was very controversial in Saudi Arabia because it ran counter to the official position of the regime. So what I want to say is that the split that is going on now is particularly significant because it reveals the instability of the ideological formula that gave birth to the Sahwa. You remember, Muslim Brotherhood plus Wahhabism. Somehow these two elements cannot really coexist together. One has taken over the other. And basically, the debate now is which element is taking over. So Nasser al-Oman and Safa Ali are probably more Wahhabi than Muslim Brotherhood, while Salman al-Awda is probably more Muslim Brotherhood than he's Wahhabi. To conclude, I should say that this split today, and the split I have described in the case of the Saudi Sahwa, goes far beyond the Sahwa. And today it concerns most of the global Islamist movement, which is itself, to some extent, a blend of Wahhabism and Muslim Brotherhood ideology. For instance, when Zarqawi in Iraq and Zarqawi and his disciples made the Shia the prime target of their jihad, they were just taking Wahhabi teachings very seriously. And when Zawahiri responded in the wake of the Hezbollah attack on Israel in summer 2006 by calling for the unity of the oppressed, al-mustada'fin he used, that was a very interesting term, of course, it has a lot of meaning in Islamist thought. And he calls on the unity of the mustada'fin, of the oppressed, whoever they may be, behind al-Qaeda, in his view. That's just opposing Zarqawi-like Islamists with like a more Muslim Brotherhood-like view, a more inclusive view. Abu Musab al-Suri, though he is a marginal voice in the global jihadi movement, he has directed the same criticism as those Salafi sheikhs like Abu Qatada, for instance, who, because they insist on the purity of doctrine, alienate from the jihadi movement many potential supporters. And what Abu Musab al-Suri says, basically, and that's also a very Muslim Brotherhood-like point of view, is that giving too much importance to Wahhabi teachings is strategically counterproductive. So this split today is at the center of all Islamist debates. And, well, the question is it just a temporary debate? Or does this mean that a whole chapter of the history of Islamist ideology is about to be closed? Time will tell. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stefan. That's a fascinating and thought-provoking presentation. It partly recalls the comment that a current senior government official used to make before he was in government when he heard about an insurgency going on. His first question always was, which side should we arm? That's especially a problem here.
Yeah.
What's the possibility that, I mean, you talked about the contradictions inherent in the Sahwa movement. What's the possibility that, in fact, neither side really triumphs and instead they're replaced by some sort of neo-Wahhabi quietist movement that sort of what happens is that Sahwa burns itself out, and rather than the Wahhabi side of Sahwa or the Muslim Brotherhood side of Sahwa winning, in fact, some third Ralph Nader like candidate comes up from behind and displaces both in the center.
That's a possibility, but for the moment, I don't see any such candidate emerging because Salman al-Awda and Safa al-Hawali and Nasser al-Omar. Safa al-Hawali now, of course, is a bit has a bit been sidelined because of his sickness, but Nasser al-Omar has taken over. They are such influential figures because of what they've done, because of their activism in the 1990s, because they spearheaded the opposition, because they went to jail. So I don't really see how they could let any other figure emerge. I really have the impression that the debate is going to be polarized between these two groups and in the end, between these two figures, Salman al-Awda on one hand and Nasser al-Omar on the other hand. I don't really see who could emerge.
And there's no way that sort of state-sponsored clerics could reclaim the high ground?
No, because state-sponsored clerics do not control the Islamist networks in Saudi Arabia. And the mosques are basically controlled by the Sahwa. This is what I meant when I said that the Sahwa is the movement to look at in Saudi Arabia, because they are the ones who control grassroots Islam in Saudi Arabia. State Islam doesn't have that much importance, at least for Islamic activists in Saudi Arabia. What I mean, anyone involved in Islamic activities is to some extent the Sahwi. The government talks to those Saudis who are not really involved in Islamic activities on a day-to-day basis, who just, you know, they listen to what the Mufti says on television and they're happy, but they don't really get themselves involved in Islamic activities. Or, of course, they talk, and the Mufti is important also as a figure, whose voice resonates abroad, out beyond the borders of the Saudi kingdom. But when it comes to grassroots Islamic activism in Saudi Arabia, the Sahwa are the ones.
All right, let me ask one more question, and they'll shut up. If you weren't so interesting, I wouldn't be nominating. The Sahwa networks, I mean, obviously the official networks are funded by the government. Mm-hmm. The Sahwa networks, I presume, have a lot of private funding from charitable individuals. Is there a way in which the government is funding, sometimes funds, these networks as well to try to buy off peace, or is there some other, I mean, do they have businesses? Are there others? How is the Sahwa financed? And does that play into this battle between the two wings?
Well, I think the Sahwa gets some private money. Salman al-Ouda, for instance, now has a foundation called Islam Today, and he earns a lot of money.
An attractive website
in several languages, and he earns a lot of money. I think he appeared recently. There was the ranking of the most in Forbes of the clerics who had earned the biggest amount of money. Salman al-Ouda, I think, ranked fifth, I think. So he was he's earning a lot of money. Of course, that money is used to fund these networks. They also get money from state institutions, because the Sahwa has always been very intermingled with the state. For instance, you have many institutions in Saudi Arabia, like all the extracurricular activities in the universities or in the schools, that are basically Sahwa institutions, but that get money for the state for their functioning. For instance, all these circles known as Tari'iyya al-Islamiyya, the Islamic conscientization. Does that make sense in English?
No.
To bring people to conscience, to bring people to Islamic conscience. So you have
Islamic consciousness.
Yeah, to develop, like, to erase Islamic consciousness. So in many Saudi schools, you have these circles that do not officially belong to the schools, but they can ask for money from the school, and they, for example, receive the students after school. It's like the scouts, for instance, or the we have comparable organizations in the West, you know, that receive the students when school is finished and socialize them in a bit different, like, religious environment. And these institutions get money from the school to finance themselves. And these institutions are usually directed by Sahwa people. So the Sahwa's presence is very close to the state, and it gets money from the state through these kind of institutions.
Thank you. I'm now going to call on people. I have three names already. If I just ask that you identify yourself, that you ask only one question until everybody's gone around, and that you actually ask your question in the form of a question, which is not a statement followed by what do you think of my statement. Flint.
Flint Leverett, the New America Foundation. I wanted to ask you what your very gripping account of the evolution of the Sahwa implies for what I'll call, for lack of a better term, King Abdullah's grand strategy. I mean, it seems to me that Abdullah is proving to be a very consequential figure in modern Saudi politics. He has presided over major changes in Saudi Arabia's economy, beginning of changes in Saudi politics, and he's done things which many of his predecessors either weren't inclined to do or couldn't have done, even if they were inclined. And you said it's basically been Abdullah who's presided over the since the rehabilitation of the Sahwa. But what does that mean for his grand strategy? Is some would suggest that what he's about is really trying to, in a sense, reinvent the Saudi state. But is that really, you think, the right way to look at what Abdullah is doing? And whatever he's doing, what does his maneuvering vis-a-vis the Sahwa tell us about his ultimate aims?
And I just underlined that while Flint raises the Abdullah issue, as you were describing this, Abdullah's role was not prominent. So I wonder if you might also comment on that aspect of his question.
Well, interestingly enough, the Abdullah in the early 1990s was a figure that was very much liked by the Sahwa. If you look at, that's very interesting, if you look at the statements of the, in 1994, of the Committee for the Defense of Legitimate Rights, which was the mouthpiece of the opposition in London, of the Sahwa, when, of course, after the repression, some of them left to London and created this so-called human rights organization. They wanted to present it as a human rights organization. In the end, it was closer to a political party. And in there, they had a weekly newsletter. And in 1994, they would be very kind with Abdullah in their commands. They considered that Abdullah, in the end, was their candidate if they had to choose among all candidates in the royal family. Interestingly enough as well, there has been reported that in 1995, I think, just before King Fahad had his stroke, even bin Laden himself in Sudan said that, oh, yes, if Abdullah becomes king, I'm ready to come back to Saudi Arabia and to settle my accounts with the royal family, to abandon a position. So it's very interesting to see that at the time, Abdullah was very popular with the Islamist opposition. And probably in 1999, when he freed them, he did so to enhance his legitimacy among a very important sector of Saudi population. Of course, you always have to think that he was trying to impose himself against his brothers at the time. He was, since 1995, the de facto ruler, but his brothers, especially Prince Nayef and Prince Sultan, still had considerable leverage on the regime. So he was probably looking for allies. And what has happened is that, Abdullah has disappointed the Sahwa sheikhs, because Abdullah, since he has been in effective power since 2005, he's been, when it comes to social issues, conducting a pretty liberal policy, of course, by Saudi standards. And the Sahwa sheikhs have resented, disagreed with this liberal turn. What is important is that Abdullah has been able to do so without arousing too much criticism, because he still has important credentials with the Sahwa. Even the Sahwa, when they disagree with him, they somehow respect him because, well, he has all this history that I've talked about in the 90s, and also they look at him as someone who's not corrupt. He's a honest figure. He's not supposed to be himself. He has a conservative lifestyle. So the Sahwa sheikhs kind of like these things. So this is very important, because this is probably the reason why he can push for some liberal reforms on social issues without arousing too much criticism. He does arouse some criticism, and there are some Sahwa petitions criticizing this or that decision. And yet, I'm sure he's the only figure capable of pushing towards social change. Now there's a lot of debate in Saudi Arabia about whether the right to drive for women will be granted. My expectation is that it will, probably next year. I think it will, because the debate is going very much in that direction. And Abdullah is probably the only figure capable of imposing that on the Sahwa. So
it's the Nixon to China moment. I have Jean-François, Tom, Rafi, Molly. Anybody else? Okay. Gotcha.
Well, it's a little bit in the general line. I mean, it seems to me that with the evolution of the economy...
But Jean-François, you have to introduce yourself. You're breaking my rule.
I am. Okay, I'm Jean-François Seznec from Georgetown University. And considering the present economic development of the kingdom, which is really coming from the top, and I cannot see that this economic development, the booming growth of industry is actually supported by the Sahwa. But it is being really brought forth by the king and his advisors at Tuecheri and Al-Gosebi, who are really managing a lot of these affairs of the state today. So I'm wondering to which extent the Sahwa has not been bypassed by this economic development, whether that's not a policy, in fact, of Abdullah to promote and push this economic development so that the country will move into the 21st century, bring the women into the workforce, decrease the need for foreigners and so on, and basically sideline, marginalize the Sahwa. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what you thought of that.
Well, I think the Sahwa remains important for one reason. They're the only person that are that are organized and that are capable of mobilizing in Saudi Arabia. The only individuals capable of having 10,000 people in the streets are the Sahwa. Not the liberals, not the westernized elites. The only ones who can create some trouble are the Sahwa. This is why they're important. Well, for the moment, I'm not sure that deindustrialization can in itself change that. The Sahwa persons linked to the Sahwa are themselves entrepreneurs and they're taking part in the growth. And but for them, it's not forbidden to.
On the issue though of education, which you mentioned is so important. I mean, what's happening today is that the king is really taking away the whole education. I mean, not the whole, but a good bit of the educational system away from the Sahwa. I mean, this whole idea of developing the King Abdullah University and giving the management of it to Saudi Aramco, I think, is a telltale position.
Yeah, this means that he can't reform the Saudi system. So it's more, for me, it's more acknowledging a failure to do that. Because the Saudi system is very difficult to reform for the very reason that for the Sahwa, the Sahwa, when I talk about social activism, the Sahwa has always focused on education. They consider that their mission is to upbring a new generation of politically conscious Saudis in an Islamic way. And that this is, so the education system is central to their strategy. They can't let the education system go, otherwise, to some extent, it will be suicide for them. And also because the issue of reforming the education system, because it was talked about in the West, in Saudi Arabia, it has become a very problematic issue. They can't leave any ground on this issue. Otherwise, for them, it will be a defeat. So it has become, and even people who are quite liberal, when you talk to them, when it comes to reforming the education system, they will say no because the Americans have said it. So we have to say no. So for me, that idea of King Abdullah bypassing the Saudi education system is more the acknowledgement of a failure to reform it from within, and just you create something on the side.
Tom Lippman, Middle East Institute. Stefan, you talked, I certainly agree with you that Desert Storm was a seminal event in this drama that you've outlined for us here. But I want to ask about another one. In his book, The Siege of Mecca, Yaroslav Trofimov examines the takeover of the Great Mosque in 1979 by Utebi and his followers. And he argues that even though Utebi and his followers either died in the siege or were executed, they lost the battle, but in an important way, they won the war. Because the regime, the rulers of Saudi Arabia, were in effect so frightened by what they saw, what they heard from Utebi, that it led them to give in to his demands, in effect, and to encourage the what you might call the social Islamists and to implant them more deeply into the education system and the structures of Saudi Arabia, and that this, in fact, is the force that Abdullah now has to reckon with. What do you think of that?
Oh, I agree with that. I agree with that. Organizationally, it's very different people. The 1979 people, Juhayman al-Artabi and his group, had nothing to do with the Sahwa. They came from a completely different strain. They were very opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood. They were purists. They were in favor of a pure Wahhabism, which would get rid of all Muslim Brotherhood influences. So they were very opposed to these Muslim Brotherhood influences. And they were very different from the Sahwa in many, many, many things. And they were enemies. In the 1970s, you would have even fights between the Sahwa people and this group, the Jama Salafiya Muhtasiba, the Salafi group, which commands good and prevents wrongdoing, which is the group out of which emerged Juhayman al-Taibi and his group. So they're very different. And in that sense, there's no relation. Where there is relation, and you're very right, is that after 1979, the regime gave many sectors that the Sahwa didn't yet control to the Sahwa, because it thought that the easiest way to prevent the rise of another Juhayman was to give in to the Sahwa. So the Sahwa replaced this earlier group that I call the rejectionists. But there are two different strains. Where I disagree with Yaroslav Trofimov is that the Sahwa itself is distinct from the jihadis. So you can't make the line that it leads to al-Qaeda, because the Sahwa itself is different from the jihadis. He wants, probably it's because also for marketing purposes, that he says it's the birth of al-Qaeda, whatever. But I disagree with jumping from the Sahwa to al-Qaeda, because it's a different trend. For instance, just to give an example, in the 1980s, the Sahwa was very opposed to its followers going to Afghanistan to fight. Very opposed. They disagreed. They said, we are the Arabian Peninsula. This is where everything happens. We're not going to fight in Afghanistan. From a Wahhabi point of view, they wouldn't go, because they said that the Afghans were not pure Muslims. They were they worshipped graves and whatever. So if Saudis go there, their Islam would be... they would have received bad influences. And they also said that the priority is to focus on this Arabian Peninsula, which is the center of everything, and not to go fight in that distant land. So they were very, very opposed to their followers going to Afghanistan. So that, of course, undermines a bit the link between Sahwa and the jihadis.
But generally supportive of jihad in Iraq.
Yeah, they are, but not in the more like in the classical jihadi sense, not like in al-Qaeda sense. Because the Sahwa today condemns al-Qaeda. They condemn what we call the global jihad. But they consider that Iraq is just like Afghanistan in the 80s or whatever. It's a Muslim land occupied by foreign invaders, so it's a legitimate jihad. But of course, they would disagree with attacks on Europe or the US or whatever, which belongs to another category, which is global jihad.
Right.
And that's, yeah. But yeah, today they supported jihad in Afghanistan in the 80s. What they disagreed with is their followers going there. They said it was a jihad, but they disagreed with Saudis going there. Okay. This is what I mean.
Rafi.
I'm Rafi Danziger from APAC. And Flint actually preempted my main question, so I'll ask this a backup question. And that is with regard to the presence of a Sahwa outside Saudi Arabia. You mentioned former presence in London. Are they present also some other Arab countries? And if they are there, what kind of influence do they have? How do the governments view them? Or is it basically just Saudi Arabia with some outpost in London? What's going on outside?
No,
Saudi Arabia?
The Sahwa is present in many, many countries. The thing is, when people talk about Wahhabis, I mean, the Sahwa is present in the United States, by the way. I mean, the people that are called Salafis in the United States and linked to Saudi Arabia, many of them are Sahwa. So when the Saudi Islam was exported to different countries, be they Middle Eastern countries or be they Western countries, it was exported in all its forms, and the different forms competed to have more influence on the export process. The Sahwa was one of the forms. So the Sahwa has been present in the U.S. For example, remember this, what's his name, Ali Tamimi, I think he was in the U.S. He was under trial or something some time ago, for running a website that had controversial material. Ali Tamimi, he was a follower of Saf al-Hawali. So and he had a mosque. I don't remember where it was actually in the U.S. Yeah, and so the Sahwa is present in many, many countries. The other strains of Saudi Islam are also present, and they're competing inside Saudi Arabia, and they're competing in other countries. But it's not an only Saudi phenomenon for sure.
Molly Williamson. What is your analysis of how the Sahwa wishes to influence a post-Abdullah, the next generation of leadership, and how would they preposition their influence and with which branches of the family?
Well, I wouldn't say they're very much involved in family, royal family politics. They're more like a grassroots, trying to create a new generation of grassroots activists that would, you know, in their mind, someday, you know, it, the times will be ripe and this generation will become, I mean, will rule or whatever, or will overthrow the regime, or will, I mean, it will come from a downtop thing. So they're more focused on grassroots politics than they are on royal family politics. You see what I mean? They're thinking, if you ask, in some of the writings of Muhammad Qutb, he's very clear about that. He says, this is the Medinan period. You see, the Medinan and the Meccan period. So we're in Medina now. So, you know, we're just quiet. We're waiting. This new generation is rising. You know, when times will be ripe, things will happen. But it's not the moment. For the moment, you know, it's like Hudaybiyah. You know, you make a truce with the regime. You're okay with the regime because you can't do anything else. You're too weak anyway. So just wait.
But that would imply that the family is equal in being facilitating or tolerant of Sahwa activities. It makes no difference.
The family is not. They are worried about Sahwa activities. But I think they really. But it's very difficult for them to. It's very difficult for them to curb these activities. Even if they wanted to. First, because for the moment, the Sahwa doesn't do anything that's illegal in Saudi Arabia. I mean, so it's very difficult. Second, because the ideas of the Sahwa have been spread through the education system since the 60s. They're just the mainstream in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's very difficult to go against the mainstream, even if you want to reform it. It takes a generation. They should reform the education system, and the next generation might be different. For the moment, it's very difficult to attack either the ideas or the networks. So you just have to kind of, you know, see what's going on, monitor them, but you can't do more. You can't do much more.
Steve.
Yes, Steve Bondi from the State Department. I was going to ask the question that Rafi asked, but if I can perhaps...
Thank you. It is. Okay. Refine it a little bit further. To what extent do either branch of the Sahwa network that you've described able to project their influence into areas, let's say Islamic communities outside the Arab world, South Asia, East Asia, mm-hmm. and kind of what tools do they have at their disposal? Are there schools, charities, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, what they do, for instance, is that, let's take an example. The Islamic University of Medina, 80% of the students are foreigners. They come and then they leave back and they come back to their countries. All these different groups are competing in the Islamic University of Medina to control the different departments. At the moment, the Sahwa is a bit weak in the Islamic University of Medina. The reason is, in 1990, when the Sahwa became an opposition movement, the regime supported their enemies. They're called the Madkhalis, usually, the followers of Rabi al-Madkhali. They are apolitical. They say that politics in itself is a sin. So and you have to be loyal to the rulers. They're very Wahhabi in their worldview and in the vision of the Shia and whatever. But when it comes to the ruler, you obey and you don't discuss. So at the moment, this group is a bit more prominent in the Islamic University of Medina than the Sahwa. So in the 1980s, for instance, someone who studied at the Islamic University of Medina would likely become a Sahwi, and he would come back as a Sahwi to his country. After 1990, things have changed, and this group is more prominent now. Sahwa presence is still there. So if someone studies at the Islamic University of Medina, it just depends in which department, with which professor, in which network socialized. All these networks compete to get the students under their influence. In the other universities, it's the same. In the charities, it's the same. Charities are controlled by some of these groups, either the Sahwa or the Madkhalis or the other groups. That's the way.
Association of Muslim Youth, Muslim World League,
yeah.
Organizations like that.
Mm-hmm. The Muslim World League is a bit different because it always has had an international leadership, not exclusively Saudi. So you have many Muslim Brotherhood people, by the way. And the Saudis who are there, they're mostly Sahwa people. So the Muslim World Youth is very much a Sahwa organization, for instance. And you could see, if you look at the books that were distributed by the Muslim World Youth in the 80s, for instance. Now it's a bit less because it's become more problematic, but in the 80s. You would find next to each other Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab and Sayyid Qutb. Both books next to each other. That's the way it worked. That's the Sahwa formula.
Kristen.
Kristen Diwan, American University. I can't resist, since you're managing the research program in Kuwait. Just saw that the Salafis had a better election this last election than the Muslim Brotherhood in Kuwait. And I'm interested about the links between the Sahwa and the Salafis in Kuwait, the different Salafi strains of Kuwait, and how they link up.
Right.
How deep those connections are.
Actually, the Kuwait program I'm managing is not a program only on Kuwait. It's on the Gulf in general, but it's called the Kuwait program. But yeah, I know Kuwait a bit, but I'm not an expert, but I try to answer your question. In Kuwait, things have been a bit different because you've had one movement that appeared in the early 70s, which has dominated the whole Salafi scene, Jamia Ihya al-Turas, the revival of Islamic heritage, al-Islami, al-Turas al-Islami. In the 90s, so it's been the main Salafi group in the 70s and 80s. After the Gulf War, there was a split. And a group that... So in the 70s and 80s, all these different divisions that existed in Saudi Arabia didn't really exist in Kuwait. Everybody pretended to belong to one group. After 1990, the tensions became so strong in Saudi Arabia between the different groups that the different followers in Kuwait started fighting with each other. And one group appeared called Salafiyya Ilmiyya. This is the Sahwa, the Salafiyya Ilmiyya, the scientific Salafiyya, they call them in Kuwait. People like, Abdel Razak, Shaiji, yeah. He was one of the, of course, he's very famous in Saudi Arabia, by the way. He's written a lot of books. And at the same time, when the Madkhalis appeared in Saudi Arabia, Madkhalis appeared in Kuwait. Abdullah Sept, who was one of the early founders, took the Madkhali line. So apolitical, loyal to the regime, and anti-Sahwa. So all these groups appeared little by little. What's different in Kuwait is that because the context is different, these Salafis are faced with choices that the Saudi Salafis are not faced with. For instance, creating a political party. Saudi Salafis wouldn't dream of creating a political party because it's forbidden. In Kuwait, the issue arose among Salafiyya Ilmiyya, the Sahwa, the local Sahwa. And they first created this Haraka Salafiyya, which was a Haraka. It was not really a party, it was a movement. But yet it was a formalized organization. That's very problematic in Salafi thought. And even as a Sahwa, the right of creating a movement, like institutionally creating a movement, because it resembles Western parties. So, of course, there's always this thing of not doing what the kuffar do. So some of the Kuwaiti Salafis have said that it was permitted to create a party. And lately, there was another development with Hizb al-Ummah, the party of the Ummah, in 2005, I think, or 2006, which is another split from the Haraka Salafiyya, and which says that it's a political party. Explicitly, which also is a very interesting development in Salafi thought. And Hakim al-Mutairi, the main ideologue, has written a book called Al-Hurriya al-Tawfan, liberty or Tawfan. Can anyone help me introduce Tawfan in English? Deluge? Did you say deluge? Yeah. Liberty or deluge. And it's a very interesting way of justifying party politics in Salafi terms, relying on Wahhabi legacy, Wahhabi text and whatever, but to justify the creation of political party and the right to participate in a kind of democratic system. So, yeah, Kuwait is very interesting because the context is different. The Salafis evolved in a very different way. But what's interesting now is that with the globalization, these ideas come back to Saudi Arabia and create debates among Saudi Salafis. So Hurriyat Tawfan is a Kuwaiti book, but it's read in Saudi Arabia, and people say, yeah, we should do the same. So, of course, that creates also probably problems for the Saudi regime.
Any other first-round questions? Robert.
Hi, I'm Robert Bentley. I'm currently at Brookings. Stefan, fascinating presentation. My question relates to the attitude of the Saudi regime towards the Sahwa. And clearly the ruling family pays some attention to what these guys are doing, but my impression is that following Saudi Arabia since the mid-1990s, they don't pay very much attention, that these guys do a lot both outside Saudi Arabia and within Saudi Arabia in terms of organizing and propagandizing and putting out doctrines and so forth, which in many ways kind of chip away at the foundations of Al Saud rule. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what your own perception is of that, what your analysis is of that.
Well, they haven't probably paid... they have paid attention, but what happened after 2003, interestingly, is that the Sahwa has managed to convince the regime that it was the most effective way of preventing the youth from subscribing to jihadism. They say, in Arabic, they say, yamsakun al-shabab, they hold the youth. So, if the Sahwa sheikhs are removed, then, the youth might go in anywhere. They might follow any entrepreneur, sheikh, with radical ideas. So the Sahwa has managed to say to the regime, we have the summer camps. Okay, the summer camps, you criticize them. But if the youth don't go to the summer camps, where are they going to go? You disagree with some of the things we say, probably. But, at least we make the youth... good Muslims, and we convince them that jihadism is wrong. And that's basically what the Sahwa has been doing. They've been very very keen on denouncing jihadism and, in its global form, Al-Qaeda, whatever. Of course, jihadism and the attacks in Saudi Arabia, telling the youth, of course, not to join this movement, that this was wrong. But the price to pay is that, of course, transmit to the youth a worldview that is in itself potentially problematic. The regime has been forced to some extent to rely on them. I mean, obviously when Safar al-Hawali even himself mediated between the jihadis and the state and managed to have one jihadi turn himself or surrender to the state, that was very significant of of the power of the Sahwa in putting itself as a mediator and a protector of the state. So it's they've benefited a lot from all that's been happening since 2003, obviously.
Jean-François, you get the last word.
I'm absolutely fascinated by your statement about the Sahwa being in Medina and moving forward to Mecca in the long run. It's a very depressing thought, I might add. I still want to push a little bit my idea of marginalization. I think the royal family is very much aware, perhaps a little bit in disagreement with Robert on this, that they are very much aware of the risk of the Sahwa controlling the youth in particular, as you say. And I think their way out of that is to make sure that the structure of society changes so rapidly under modern, with the globalization and whatnot, that the Sahwa will be bypassed and that the youth will eventually find good jobs at good wages, and you change the educational system to bring more science and so on. They talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. They are not, as you pointed out, the Sahwa knows very well that's the core of their power, and they're going to fight it. But everybody else is fighting it. Every merchant that I know is starting his own school in mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia. The King Abdullah City has given the management to Saudi Aramco of this new research center. I think everybody's aware that they have to change that and really wrestle it away from the Sahwa. So yes, it is a statement of failure that Abdullah has not been able to remove the Sahwa from the educational system, but in a very Saudi way, they're just creating a parallel system.
just like they did in the law, where they put, you know, the commission for the settlement of grievances instead of changing the commercial law. Mm-hmm. And so they're doing a parallel system, hoping that this parallel system will take over. Mm-hmm. So I did exactly what John didn't want me to do, the statement. And what do you think of my statement?
We'll still invite you back.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, yes, I do agree. And at the same time, what the regime has been doing with the Sahwa is that the Sahwa is there. Changing things would be something considerable. You have to change social balances that have been there for 40 years. It takes a lot of time and a lot of efforts. And so it's very interesting what they're doing with King Abdullah University and these things. I'm not sure it will be enough. And at the same time, the Sahwa, they're very happy with the Sahwa, for instance, having played a key role in ending the jihadi campaign in Saudi Arabia. The Sahwa played a key role, because the Sahwa, if it was not for the Sahwa preventing the youth from joining the jihadis on the ground, probably the campaign would have been much longer and much more violent. So really, the Sahwa have been able to play a key role in curbing the jihadi campaign. But of course, then they ask for things in exchange. They say, you know, we've helped you, now help us. So with the social forces and the social balance now in Saudi Arabia, the regime couldn't do anything else than support the Sahwa against the jihadis. Changing this would take at least a generation and probably require a bit more than just bypassing the system. It's always the problem in Saudi Arabia because there's never radical change. Change is always gradual, a bit there, a bit there. That's fine. But if you want to change the system as it is, it's going to take a bit more, I guess.
I don't think that's a happy note, but it's the note that we'll end on. I want to thank you all for coming. I especially want to thank Stefan for a really illuminating and thought-provoking presentation. I go to a lot of things in Washington. I don't think there's one that stirred so many juices in my brain as that one, so I appreciate your coming. We look forward to seeing you again. Thanks.
Thank you so much.